The following program is made possible with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Tvameva Mata cha Pita Tvameva Tvameva Bandhu cha Sakha Tvameva Tvameva Vidya Dravinam Tvameva Tvameva Sarvam Mama Deva Deva.
I think Hinduism is the name of a way of life. And anybody who has been born and brought up in India has a touch of it. I think for the practicing Hindu, he looks at his religion as a way of life where the gods and the goddesses and the human beings are in a kind of a continuity.
Passages to India, a series created by Julian Crandall Hollick. In this program, we look at Hinduism in the daily lives of Indians. It's called simply Puja, Darshan Dena, Darshan Lena.
The shadow on the sundial inches nearer to midday. Then the conch shell will blow to mark the birth of Ram, the legendary king of Ayodhya, one of the most popular and beloved of all the forms of God that Hindus worship.
His name is Ram, and he was born in the house of Ikshvaku. All men know of him, for he is self-controlled, mighty, radiant, steadfast, and masterful. His shoulders are broad and his arms mighty. He is renowned, learned, and pure, disciplined and contemplative, the protector of all living things and the guardian of righteousness.
मर्यादा पुरुषोत्तम भगवान श्री राम को अपना यानी कि वो भगवान करके मानता हूँ।
I personally revere and consider Lord Rama as my God.
Why Lord Rama for you? Why not somebody else?
भगवान राम का जो है जैसे हमारे यहाँ रामचरितमानस है रामायण
I have been always been taught and reading the Ramayana, and because for a long time I've been reading that, so my reverence is also as a result more and more toward Rama. He is the ideal for me.
The crowd sinks back exhausted, released after days and nights of chanting prayer and mounting excitement. Ram has come again to help ease the burden and pain of human existence.
Mm-hmm.
Hinduism doesn't lend itself easily to definition. The more you read about it, the less you feel you know. There's no one Bible, no real founder, no supreme pope, and no single catechism. It's a bewildering mass of possibilities and contradictions. Everything is tolerated. Everything is absorbed. Hinduism is like the proverbial sponge that in the course of time absorbs everything that it considers good, right, and exemplary. Everyone can pray to whomever and whatever he or she likes. The whole universe is sacred. As the gods say, if someone prays to a tree or a rock, I will be there to hear him. And the gods are symbols and forms of the energy in the cosmos, colored fragments of the prism of pure light. India is made up of many different peoples and many different histories. Each god, therefore, has many different legends. Everyone chooses the story that suits them best. Who cares if there are several different and contradictory explanations of the birth and deeds of their favorite god? For each contains a lesson.
The primeval man, Purusha, was lonely. He wanted a companion to share the universe with. So he divided himself into two beings, husband and wife. He made love to the wife, and this is how mankind was born. The primeval man wanted to have more children with the woman, but she said, "No, I'm your daughter, and what we have done is incest. This has got to stop." And so she ran away. But the primeval man desired her and set out after her. So she turned herself into a mare to escape his attentions. But he became a stallion and ran after her and covered her. And that's how horses were created. And then she ran away again and became a cow. But he became a bull and ran after her and covered her. And that's how cows and bulls were made. She became a she-goat, he became a billy-goat. She became a ewe, he became a ram and united with her. And from this, goats and sheep were born. And this is how the primeval man created all the animals, both male and female, right down to the ants.
We tend to think of our mythologies as fairy tales, fantastic stories from a primitive past. We like to think that we're too sophisticated to believe in myths and make-believe. But of course, we're really no different from the rest of the world. We also have our mythologies, only we fail to recognize them as we live them out. In India, mythologies are inseparable from reality. They're alive and well, part and parcel of most people's daily existence.
You see, they function at various levels. At the surface level, they are entertaining stories, nice stories. But at the deeper level, they are educative. They instruct you. They teach you morals. At the philosophical level, you see, they teach you the philosophy of life. How to live, how to think, how to communicate with God, and how to achieve nirvana.
And it's the same with stories about the gods and goddesses. Before writing a book, playing a concert, or shooting a film in India, you start by making an offering or puja to Ganesha. Ganesha is a chubby little adolescent god who rides a rat. He also has the head of an elephant and a long trunk to clear away any obstacles. He's therefore a useful person to have on your side.
The god Shiva married Parvati, the daughter of the mountain Himalaya. Now Parvati wanted to have a child, but Shiva refused. "I'm the god of yogis, so it wouldn't be right for me to indulge myself." But this was really an excuse. In fact, Shiva was already having second thoughts about marriage. So the last thing he wanted was to be tied down with children.
It's bad enough having a wife in the first place. I'm damned if I'm going to have a child as well. This made Parvati very sad. She wanted a child so badly. So badly that it became an obsession. And the obsession became so powerful that it eventually became reality. And this is how it happened. One day, Parvati took a bath. She ran the water and then she added perfumed oils and then got in and began to wash herself. As she washed her body, the oils and the dirt from her body mixed, and from that substance was formed a child. And she called the child Ganesha. Parvati loved Ganesha very much, but Shiva resented his presence, and the marriage didn't get any smoother or happier. One day, Parvati decided to take a nice long bath without any interruptions. So she summoned Ganesha and said, "I'm going to take a bath now. I want you to stay at the door of the bathroom. I don't want anybody barging in. I want to be alone. Don't let Shiva in." But of course, Shiva did try to come into Parvati's bathroom. So Ganesh stood in front of the door and made himself very tall and said as loudly as he could, "Stop! You can't go in there. My mother asked me to keep everybody out, and that includes you, Shiva." Shiva was furious. "How dare you?" And he struck him with his fist and knocked his head off. Parvati rushed out and collapsed on the floor, beside herself with grief. "Please, Shiva, please do something. Give my son Ganesh back his head. You can do anything if you want. Please do this for me, for our son." Shiva went off muttering, "Well, I'll see what I can do." He sent for one of his servants and told him to go and find a new head. "Take the head of the first creature you see. I don't care whose it is." The servant left. The first creature he set eyes on was an elephant. So he took the elephant's head, returned to Mount Kailasha, and put this head onto Ganesha's body. And this is why Ganesha has the body of a child and the head of an elephant.
The creator god was called Prajapati. One day he decided to sacrifice himself, and from his sacrifice came the universe, the gods, and mankind. And from the parts of his body came the four varnas, or classes, which form the backbone of Hindu society.
His mouth was the Brahmin. His arms were made into the nobles. His two thighs were the populace. And from his feet, the servants were born. The moon was born from his mind. The sun was born from his eye. From his mouth came Indra and Agni. And from his breath, the wind, Vayu, was born. From his navel, the atmosphere was born. From his head, the heaven appeared. From his two feet came the earth, and the regions of the sky from his ear. Thus they fashioned the worlds.
So the gods and mankind come from the same cosmic creation. And in the eyes of the Hindu, a man or a woman can become a saint, even a god. And of course, by the same token, a god can become a man or a woman. We're all made of the same stuff.
Vishveshwar darshan kar Vishveshwar Vishveshwar darshan kar Vishveshwar
India has 2 million gods and worships them all. In religion, all other countries are paupers. India is the only millionaire.
And then, of course, as Mr. Mark Twain discovered, there is the universe of the gods. What confusion and incomprehension they've caused us in the West. How can there be so many? By what strange cultural osmosis can the same god pop up in different parts of the country with a different name, a different physical form, and a completely different character?
The Veda says that all the gods are manifestations of energy only. Now, we have given forms according to our own, you know, imaginations or our own beliefs.
Culturally, if you can imagine a Greece where the gods are still alive. I went to Greece 5 years ago in search of Apollo, and I couldn't find him because he was no longer alive for the Greeks. But for us, the gods are alive. There is a living, pulsating cultural tradition.
We have a saying that we have 300 million gods. That means everyone living in the country had his own god.
Hinduism believes that the divine can express itself in a million different ways. You cannot tie down the divine.
God has no form. How can it be right to worship an image? First, realize that you too are without form. That's your essential nature. When you realize that you too are without form, you will realize that he is also without form. So long as you think you have a form, there's no harm if you conceive of him also as a form, as an image.
For any Hindu, you give him a piece of stone or clay or anything, and he will visualize all the forms in it and start worshipping it.
Pandi Coils, a small rural shrine near the South Indian city of Madurai. On a Friday, this tiny shrine set amongst the fields of emerald green rice paddy has been likened to hell on earth. The image of Pandi is of human height, dark-skinned and angry-looking. Pandi is the name of the original kings of this corner of India. He's also a very powerful god. Most of the people coming here are young girls seeking husbands or hoping to become pregnant. Every few minutes, another woman emerges from the tall grass like a hunted animal. But she isn't running away. She's possessed by Pandi. The crowd lined up to make their offering to Pandi step aside and let this favored devotee see and be seen by the god. Then friends drag the exhausted woman to one side. One woman, Sushila, claims to have been possessed by Pandi once a week since the age of 7. The god speaks through her, and people often come to her house to hear what he has to say. Today, Sushila wants Pandi's help. Her younger sister's got family problems, and her son wants to become assistant branch manager in the insurance company he works for. Other women have come with sons and daughters, their heads completely shaved, to thank the god.
His name is Pandi. He named after the deity. He's the first child of the family. They come from south of Madurai. It's about 20 kilometers from here, from the village. He was born after the parents made a vow in this temple. That is why once in a year or sometimes if they miss 1 year for certain reasons, they come the next year to give pongal, to offer puja and sacrifice a goat. All his kith and kins and other relatives come to join them for that. So they're going to have a big feast.
Nobody really knows who Pandey is. I've been told that 10 years ago he was worshipped by just a handful of families. Then word got around that he had magical powers, and villagers began coming here in increasing numbers. They've now made a pavement up to the shrine and covered it with corrugated iron. There's also a well so the villagers can perform the ritual washing before making their offering. And a sandy corner in full view of the god has become the spot where goats are tethered before their throats are slit. The sand there is stained, a dull and black and red. On this Friday, at least a dozen goats have been sacrificed. Pandey's an upwardly mobile god. Already there's talk here that he's really Lord Shiva, one of the great trinity of Hindu gods who dominate religious life throughout the country. In the Vishwanath temple in the holy city of Benares, 30 able-bodied men are putting the god Shiva to bed. They're barefoot, wearing cotton vests and dhoti. Foreheads are smeared with a white paste of ashes, a sign of their adherence to Lord Shiva. One man swings a large bell, another a tray of smoking incense. Shiva's statue is garlanded with marigolds. On the stone slab in front of the god, a little brass bowls filled with offerings of oil, water and fruit, arranged delicately on pieces of palm leaf. When they finish singing Shiva's praises, the bells clang out in dissonant ecstasy. The conch shell blows, and outside a group of musicians prepare to leave down the dark and narrow gully or lane to announce to the inhabitants of the city that Lord Shiva has finally gone to bed. A small band marches cheerfully off. A couple of lean pie dogs tag on behind. A motorcyclist brings up the rear. Shiva's probably the oldest of the major Hindu gods who are worshipped today. He may have been a fertility god in South India before the Vedas. By that curious process of osmosis and amalgamation which is Hinduism, he took on the character of a Vedic god called Rudra, who was rather violent and destructive. Shiva's a great ascetic and sits on a tiger skin on the slopes of the mythical Mount Kailasha in the Himalayas, deep in meditation. It's thanks to his meditating that the world is maintained. His earthly home is in Benares, or to give it its old name, Kashi. When the world comes to an end, Shiva will recreate it here on the banks of the Ganges. In the center of his forehead is a third eye, emblem of his superior wisdom and insight. And from his long and matted hair flows the river Ganges, and thereby hangs a tale.
There was once a king who had performed 99 horse sacrifices. As he was about to perform the 100th, Indra, the king of the gods, became jealous, because Indra is the only one in the world who's completed 100 horse sacrifices. So when the 100th was in session, he stole the horse and carried it away. The king was desperate to get back the horse to complete the sacrifice. He told his 100 sons to find the horse, and they went everywhere looking for it, and they couldn't find it. Finally, they became desperate and rather destructive, and they began digging up the earth, and they began killing the plants that lived in the earth, and they dug deeper and deeper down into the bowels of the earth until they came across a mysterious sage meditating. Now the sage was really Shiva, but the brothers didn't know this, and they started pushing him aside looking for the horse. And he became angry and opened his third eye and burnt them to ashes. The king was naturally very upset. He didn't have his horse and he'd lost all his sons. How could he get them back? Many years later, he found out from a Brahmin sage that the only way to revive them would be to have the waters of the Milky Way in heaven flow over them. He prayed and prayed and did great penances. And finally, the Milky Way agreed to come down to earth. But, she said, if I fall from heaven to earth, I will destroy the earth. I'll split it up and shatter it. What am I to do? So the king went to Shiva and said, would you please hold the Ganges when she comes down to earth and help break her fall? Shiva agreed. She can wander through my hair, and by the time she's done that, her fall will have been broken. So Shiva sat on Mount Kailash, and the Milky Way came down from heaven, wound her way through his matted hair, and then flowed out of the Himalayas, across the ashes of the 100 suns who were brought back to life. Then she flowed into that great big hole which we call the ocean. And this is how Ganga came down to earth.
Most human beings have a good and a bad side. Shiva also has this basic duality. He's both a creator and a destroyer, an ascetic, yet highly erotic. In fact, he's often symbolized in the shape of a stone lingam or phallus. His followers, who are called Shaivites, probably worship it simply as a symbol of Shiva. But many Western visitors to India have preferred to dwell on its sexual imagery. The French Abbé Dubois, who visited India in the 18th century, was very offended.
C'est incroyable! C'est pas possible que le peuple adore des objets dont le nom même est une insulte à la pudeur.
Now, this is what really happened.
There was once a group of sages in a pine forest in the Himalayas. They claimed to be religious ascetics who had conquered the temptations of the flesh, but in their hearts they still felt desire and lust for women. This was hard on their wives, who were young and beautiful and full of normal passions. They became very, very frustrated. Shiva decided to teach these hypocritical sages a lesson, so he disguised himself as a beautiful and naked young beggar and wandered into the forest. The wives were overjoyed to see this beautiful naked man, and they began to dance and sing and caress and make love to him. Naturally, the sages were furious and very jealous. They cursed the beggar and said, "You've made love to our wives. May you lose your phallus." And because a curse is very powerful, the young man's phallus fell to the ground. Now, Shiva, of course, wasn't vulnerable to their curses, but to teach them a lesson, he decided to continue to make them think he was a mere beggar. So he let his phallus fall to the ground. But Shiva's lingam is also the flame of the universe, which gives light to the earth. So when it fell off, the sun and the moon went out, and the world was plunged into complete darkness. The sages realized they had made a serious error. So they went to the god Brahma and pleaded for help against Shiva's anger. Brahma replied, "You have indeed made a serious error. I suggest you go back to Shiva and apologize." So they went back to Shiva and sung his praises and apologized profusely. Shiva said, "You said you're sorry, so I'm going to take back my phallus. But in penance for your mistake, I command you to worship it forevermore." And that is how man came to worship the lingam and why it represents Lord Shiva in all his glory.
For a devotee, Shiva's search for perfection through meditation and denial reveals one path for release from the endless cycle of rebirth. In South India, there's also a tradition of erotic poetry dedicated to Shiva, where the sexual metaphors symbolize the desire for direct union with God.
I love the handsome one. He has no death, decay, nor form, no place or side, no end, nor birthmarks. I love him, O mother, listen. I love the beautiful one, with no born nor fear, no clan, no land, no landmarks for his beauty. So my lord, white as jasmine, is my husband. Take these husbands who die, decay, and feed them to your kitchen fires.
लक्ष्मीकांतं कमलनयनं ज्योतिर्ध्यानगम्यं वन्दे विष्णुं भवहरं सुबलोकैकनाथं नीलाम्बुजश्यामलकमलनयनं श्रीकृष्णं।
It's a cool November night in the little village of Jitvapur in the northern state of Bihar. Surajdev Jha's family have gathered by the light of oil lamps to celebrate the awakening of Vishnu, Shiva's great rival amongst the pantheon of Hindu gods. The night's pitch black except for two candles placed in the middle of a small compound of mud huts. Surajdev Jha and his family live in three of these one-room huts. The fourth is reserved for Vishnu. On the earth in front of Vishnu's hut, Surajdev's mother has drawn an alpana, a sacred drawing of white rice powder, to welcome the god as he wakes after a sleep of 6 months. A small piece of cloth has been spread on the ground. On it are placed tiny brass bowls filled with oil, water, marigold leaves and fruit, all placed on pieces of palm tree leaves. Over this tableau, Harikan Jha, the family priest, squats, little bell in his hand, repeating the sacred prayers. In a tiny basket, Vishnu, in the form of a 6-inch clay figure, sleeps in a bed of raw silk.
Jadinidram jagatpate he jagatpate he malik jadinidram so ye sona chhod dijiye nidram.
One of the way of calling the god is in the Indian term is Govind. So he says, Govind, you are supreme, you are supreme to the entire world. When the Govind wakes up, all the three worlds, that is the earth, under the earth and above the earth, they all wake up with him.
All across India, millions of men and women are waking their gods, dressing them, feeding them, taking them for walks, entertaining them with songs and dancing, sometimes in temples, often in small shrines or sanctuaries. For a Hindu, the relationship with one's God is a very personal bond. Like a good host or a good servant, the worshipper treats his God as his lord or guest with full hospitality. The God, in fact, lives within the image and is brought to life by the Brahmin pandit or priest, opening his eyes with a needle or a flick of the paintbrush. You can worship a God in the abstract, but the important thing is not just to see the image, but to be seen by the God in return. Vishnu's very different in character from Shiva. Shiva's a wild man dancing to destruction. Vishnu is the preserver of the universe. He sleeps in the primeval ocean on a thousand-headed snake called Shesha. And while he sleeps, a lotus grows out of his navel. And from the lotus, Brahma, the creator of the three worlds, is born. Vishnu is benevolent. He works for the welfare of the world. From time to time, when evil threatens this world, he disguises himself in human form and comes down to rid us of the evil. He's supposed to have come down 10 times in 10 avatars or reincarnations. Among the most famous of them were Ram and Lord Krishna. There are many different Krishnas. In the Mahabharata, Krishna is a warrior, an advisor to the Pandavas. In the Bhagavad Gita, he is Vishnu, the supreme God, who explains the purpose of life and how man can reach God. But there are other Krishnas. There's Krishna, the divine baby, who plays pranks on unsuspecting humans. And perhaps the best known is Krishna, the youthful, handsome flute player who makes love to gopis or milkmaids, and who has a torrid affair with Radha, who's also very much a married woman.
When my beloved returns to my house, I shall make my body a temple of gladness. I shall make my body the altar of joy and let down my hair to sweep it. My twisting necklace of pearls shall be the intricate sprinkled design on the altar. My full breasts, the water jars. My curved hips, the plantain trees. The tinkling bells at my waist, the young shoots of the mango. I shall use the arcane arts of fair women in all lands to make my beauty outshine 1,000 moons.
If you ask Hindus who the main gods of Hinduism are, they'll usually reply, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. But there's only one temple to Brahma in the whole of India, and that's a form of punishment because Brahma made fun of Shiva's lingam. People talk about Brahma, but nobody really worships him anymore. His place has been taken in much of the country by the goddess. In the beginning, the goddess was rather unimportant. In Bengal, she was a very minor goddess known as Chundi. In the south, she was Meenakshi, the wife of Shiva. And in much of India, bands of thieves and murderers known as Thugs worshipped her in the form of Kali, the patron goddess of murderers. But gradually she assumed and subsumed all these identities and roles and became the goddess. For many, she is supreme among all the gods as Shakti, or elemental power, greater even than Shiva. Indians worship her for very different reasons, depending on which of her multiple identities they choose to identify with. These poor widows in the Bihar countryside are praising the goddess as a way of affirming their strength as women in a society where women's role too often is still to be obedient and subservient. Central to the goddess is a basic duality and ambiguity. It's not something peculiar to her alone. You find it in Shiva. It's in fact something very basic to the Indian view of human nature.
It operates so much at the level of irrational and subconscious in our minds. But it's a very old, ancient image of which comes from fertility cults, an image of power, and more than anything else, to me, it signifies the whole magic and power of color.
Who could ever forget the face of Kali, dark-skinned, dripping with blood from her mouth?
Kali, yeah, dark, with very white eyes and red tongue, red flowers, white skulls, blood images. Violence and destruction, they are not concepts which you can say male or female, but I would say they belong to this cults, and they are not seen as negative. They are very positive concepts of change. Culturally, violence is not seen as something negative. It's for life.
Why on earth, please tell me, should you look upon God as being exclusively male? It's demonstrably ridiculous, if I may say so. Half the human race is female. So this machismo approach towards religion, to our mind, is absurd. The God is male, is female, is androgynous. And the Upanishads say as much.
Tato yuttham parishrantam samre chintya sthitam ravanam chagrato drishtva yuddhaye samupasthitam devatascha samagamya.
How and why does one choose to worship one God over another?
You are totally free. You are totally free. But you know, usually you are influenced by your tradition. Generally, because from your childhood, you start putting faith in a particular deity which is being worshipped by your ancestors.
In my parents' family, we used to worship Shiva and Rama and Krishna. And in my in-laws, they prefer only Lord Krishna. But they did not compel me to worship Lord Krishna. It was afterwards I read the literature and Gita and did some thinking about it. Then I became convinced about it.
There are different psychic vibes. I may go to a temple in the south which I've never visited, and I may suddenly see an image which says something to me. Okay, that is my way to the divine. We don't exclude anything, you see. And maybe in my younger age, I preferred Krishna. Then as I developed, some other manifestation became more important to me. And now at the present moment, I'm worshipping Shiva.
What I find very, very attractive about the goddess is a totally different conception of power. I mean, not as a notion of power to control, but a power to enable. I have a sense sometimes of a protection which is accorded by, you know, by the goddess. There have been times when I have felt very scared, cowardly, and it's been a source of strength.
Then there are the lesser gods, such as Ganesha or Hanuman, the monkey god, who helped Ram rescue Sita from Ravan's palace in Lanka, and Lakshmi, the wife of Vishnu and goddess of wealth, and Saraswati, the goddess of learning.
And each has an animal who is also sacred. Shiva, the bull Nandi, the goddess, the lion. Vishnu, the bird Garuda. Ganesh, the rat. Saraswati, the swan.
And then there are the snake spirits, or Nagas. They guard the jewels stored underground. Anthills mark the entrance to their kingdom. Sometimes the Nagas make gifts to the inhabitants of this world.
And there are Yakshas and Gandharvas who sing for the gods, and Apsaras, or beautiful nymphs, who try to seduce ascetics while they meditate to save the world.
And the Rishis, or wise men, who composed the Vedas. And the Asuras, or demons, who threaten the peace of the earth and of the universe, and of whom Ravan was the most famous.
And the sacred plants and animals, including Surabhi, the mother of all the cows, who gives man milk, butter, curd, urine and dung. Without Surabhi, man could not have survived.
And the Ganga, and all the holy rivers of India, and the sacred peepal and banyan trees, and the fig tree, and the tulsi or basil plant, which is sacred to Vishnu, and which we grow in our gardens and courtyards. All these are part of nature and are sacred to us.
Indians worship their gods in many ways. In private puja or prayers in their home. In the temple individually or at one of the aarti ceremonies. By going on a sacred pilgrimage. Or by taking part in festivals.
Today is Thursday, so we worship Lakshmi, which is the goddess of wealth. I mean, your home will be, you know, all right and all if you worship Lakshmi.
Now, when you say you worship Lakshmi, what does that mean in practical terms?
Well, we have some particular performance, flowers and sweets and fruits and all to offer her. After that, we distribute that sweets and all to the family members.
When anybody is performing a puja, he may not go to the toilet, you see, or he has to have a bath, he has to be on a fast, and, you know, and then after the puja is over, you break the fast and so on, you see. And then people who are out on orders, pilgrimages, have to keep away from meat. I mean, this is the other side of it, you see. Liquor, sex.
This is for Vishnu. You are everything. You are mother, you are father, you are brother, you are sister, you are wisdom, you are education, you are everything. And you are in me. Just that is the aim of my puja or my concentration, to find that superpower within myself.
Do you go regularly to a temple or perform puja?
No, we don't, or rather I don't go to a temple. I mean, we have a puja room at home, so I do my praying at home. And occasionally, on some festive occasion, we go to a temple.
What particular god or goddess do you worship?
We are basically Vaishnavites. I mean, we don't have a preference as such. My grandfather told me that I'm a Vaishnavite and I got to pray to this god. But I generally pray to all the gods.
Something happens. Something goes wrong.
And that's the evil eye?
That's...
And how do you send
get
it away?
Over.
Yeah.
No, that time, day and again, we have to do some pujas and all. Actually, that is a belief. But I think it's the time which takes it away. Or what is to be happen, going to happen, it will happen. Like that. I feel that way, but other family members and my mother-in-law, they are still old beliefs and all, so they quickly call the Pandit priests and all. So according to his advice, we do the pujas.
I take every day holy dip into the river. A few drops of Ganga water makes your whole body clean. When I wake up, I see the rising sun and the waters. And the first thing I do is that I go and just take holy dip, come to the temple at Tulsi Ghat, offer my prayers. I don't know about your rivers, but I have the feeling that not so many people have that sort of living relationship with the river as we have with Ganga. There are many, in several million such people who have that relationship with the river, who take the river as, means as goddess.
Groups of young girls dressed in their Sunday best. They giggle and chatter. It's early Sunday morning here in one of the main parks in Jaipur in Rajasthan. The dew is still on the earth. The girls gather flowers, then place them carefully in small brass pitchers. There are not many people about yet. Shyly, some of the girls start singing a song to the goddess Gauri. Today is the festival of Gangur. Isha and Gangur are the mythic man and wife who through the ages have remained the embodiment of marital love. These girls are gathering flowers to take to the goddess. We follow 16-year-old Poonam as she returns to her parents' apartment deep inside the old part of the walled city. In the living room, Poonam's sisters and parents have placed a 2-foot-high clay image of Gangur under the window looking out onto the courtyard. Poonam places the brass pitcher of flowers in front of the goddess. Then they all start singing.
Last year, that was my first year for performing the Gangur.
Last year, Poonam wasn't married, so she came and prayed for a husband. She did marry, and this is one of the first occasions when she's been given permission to leave her in-laws' house and return to celebrate a festival with her own family.
We are praying for our husband to have a long life. Before marriage, the girls, pray that they should get a good husband. That's, and after the marriages, they pray for their husband to have a long life.
Gangur pujas are a very old custom. It predates Hinduism and has been amalgamated into Hindu mythology and recast in terms of gods and goddesses familiar to everyone. In this case, Shiva and his wife Gauri, also known as Parvati.
Parvati has been worshipped by virgins to demand a good husband. And there is a mention in Ramayana also that the Sita, who was married to Lord Rama, did worship Parvati to demand a good husband.
In the evening, everyone lines the streets leading from the palace in the heart of the city to the tank or artificial lake where the image will be immersed. The palace gates open, and a motley procession of musicians and family retainers, in uniforms that are as antique as many of those wearing them, begin to march out. The elephants have been decorated with floral designs. They carry the Maharaja and his immediate family. Then a stretcher emerges through the gateway. 12 men, liveried in scarlet uniforms and turbans, carry on their shoulders the goddess, dressed and seated on her throne. Everyone cranes forward to catch a glimpse of her and to be seen in return. For this is darshan, the blessing that will protect them against the demons and the evil realities of this mortal life.
Puja, Darshan Dena, Darshan Lena was written and produced by Julian Crandall-Hollick and Dean Capello. The recording assistants in India were Rana Behel, Raja Chatterjee and Raj Shekharan. The theme and incidental music were composed and performed by Shubha Shankaran and Vishwanath Chaudhary. Pradeep Krishan, Bill McDonald and Sanjay Hazarika were the actors. Consultants to this program were Philip Oldenburg of Columbia University, A.K. Ramanujan and Wendy Doniger of the University of Chicago. For more information about cassette copies of this series, please phone 1-800-854-TAPE during regular business hours. Passages to India is a production of IBA, Independent Broadcasting Associates, and is made possible with major grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Rockefeller Foundation. Support for the national distribution of this program is provided by this and other National Public Radio member stations and by the NPR Cultural Program Fund. Contributors include the National Endowment for the Arts and Bramalee Pacific, master developer of Oakland, California's City Center Office Development. I'm Deepika Roy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.